Last time, we started the series on friendships. For anybody who wasn't here, for those of you who were here, we started to look at several truths about biblical friendships, and we began by defining biblical friendship in a couple of different ways. One, we defined it as a friend is a trusted confidant to whom I am mutually drawn as a companion and an ally, whose love for me is not dependent on my performance and whose influence draws me closer to God. We also said that biblical friendship exists when two or more people, bound together by a common faith in Jesus Christ, pursue Him and His kingdom with intentionality and vulnerability. Now, you can see that these definitions of friendship are redemptive in nature. They are about Christ and the pursuit of Christ in your life. We then saw that biblical friendship has a biblical foundation, the essence of God, a Trinity, an eternal communion and relationship with each other, the Father, Son, and the Spirit, and the design of God, making man in His image as a relational being, creating man to live in relationships. Secondly, we saw the purpose of biblical friendship, and that is to bring God glory by ministering to those in our friendship circles. Now, this ministry takes the form of evangelism when we're dealing with unbelievers, and the ministry takes the form of, remember the other E word? Edification. Edification when we're dealing with one another in the church. So every relationship you have has a purpose. It's about ministry. A good friend is one who promotes godliness in your life and protects you from sin. If your friendships are not about these things, then they are self-centered and they lack substance, they lack purpose. Thirdly, we saw biblical friendship requires biblical evaluation. And we began to look at some red flags that you might see in your friends to know, okay, who do I need to stay away from for a particular season or minimize my exposure to them, whatever it might be. But you need to be able to exercise discernment and evaluate the character and the influence that your peer group has to know whether they can be those who serve to promote godliness and protect you from sin. Here are the red flags we covered and ended with last week. First, ungodly viewpoints or opinions that have moral or spiritual implications. Somebody who's constantly offering up their own viewpoints that are against the truth of God's word. That's a red flag. Somebody who's anti-authority. They don't like the restriction and the submission principles that we see in Scripture. Gross hypocrisy. They are an entirely different person as soon as somebody who has any sort of authority or ability to scrutinize them, as soon as they are removed from their influence, they are an entirely different person. They start using language they would never use. They start to act in ways that they would never act around certain groups of people. Deceitful or hurtful speech. So somebody who's known for lying or slandering others. Those would be examples of someone that you'd want to stay away from. Or self-exalting speech. Someone who's constantly promoting themselves and how great they are. And they're not comfortable letting peers or friends talk about experiences they have without coming in and trumping their experiences with better ones. So self-exalting speech. Inability to control sinful emotions. So someone who's always quarreling and angry and have fits of outrage, we narrowed in on anger, that's someone who does not promote biblical friendship. And lovers and promoters of sin, we ended with that, where a person's influence, because they love sin and they love sinning to such a degree that those whom they fellowship with and interact with, they're constantly tempting them to sin and making them more vulnerable to sin's temptation. So those are the red flags that we looked at last week, and we're going to continue with a few more before we look at the green flags, so to speak, in relationships. So number eight, another red flag that you see in a peer group that should alarm you to the danger is a lack of teachability. A lack of teachability. Again, the Proverbs have much to say. You could probably just open up the Proverbs and just leave a bookmark or your thumb in the book of Proverbs, because we'll be jumping around a little bit. Proverbs have much to say about receiving instruction, receiving rebuke and exhortation. Proverbs 1:7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. Fools are not teachable. Proverbs 9:7-9, he who corrects a scoffer gets dishonor for himself, and he who reproves a wicked man gets insults for himself. Do not reprove a scoffer or he will hate you. Reprove a wise man and he will love you. Give instruction to a wise man and he will still be wiser. Teach a righteous man and he will increase his learning. So there you have just those telltale signs of whether you're around someone who is cultivating wisdom or the pride of being unteachable. Proverbs 12:15. The way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man listens to his advice. So a fool already assumes he's arrived, and he already assumes he has knowledge, so therefore he does not listen. He's not teachable. Proverbs 18:2. A fool takes no pleasure in understanding, but only in expressing his opinion. So you have someone who cannot be instructed, cannot be compassionately rebuked, so to speak, and they're only interested in espousing their opinion and acting like their opinion has some sort of weight, and they're not willing to listen to instruction. Proverbs says they're a fool. They take no pleasure in actually understanding. This is in contrast to a true biblical friend who should have a passionate hunger for learning and a genuine humility that's willing to be taught and confronted and corrected. So if there's no evidence of a spiritual appetite, longing to learn and grow in the knowledge of Christ, and if there's only prideful responses to confrontation and correction, that friend's a fool, according to Proverbs. For that season, you've got to stay away from him. So in evaluating friendships, you can think about it like this. What happens when you admonish a peer in a godly way, patiently and compassionately? How do you respond when someone patiently and compassionately admonishes you? Do you or they get repeatedly defensive and make excuses for your actions? Do you minimize your sin? Do they accuse you of legalism or self-righteousness merely because you're holding them to a standard? To the standard of their profession of faith. That's someone who's not teachable. They're not rebukable. Another way this lack of teachability is going to show up is the false assumption that older people are outdated and don't have anything wise or valuable to teach me or say to me. So a young person will purposely distance themselves from older and more mature influences. Well, a peer who's teachable knows I've got a lot to learn from older Christians who've lived longer lives, made more mistakes, sustained more suffering, and gained more wisdom than I have. This is one of the pitfalls of exclusively having friends who are all the same age and refusing to have what we call intergenerational friendships. That's why these are necessary. We need the balanced perspective and experience of people who are walking through different stages of life than us, those who have walked through battles we haven't walked through, those who have walked through temptations and been victorious. We need their perspective. So if you have peers who reject that philosophy and view older people as out of touch, as arrogant for attempting to speak into my life, you don't know me, you don't know my struggles, you can't possibly have anything profitable to say to me, that's someone who's not teachable. Number 9, a ninth red flag. Lack of conviction. You don't want to be close friends with someone who's not grounded in the truth. So a lack of conviction. When I use the word conviction, I'm referring to a firmly held belief, being convinced of something. Just listen to a couple passages on that, about the relationship between conviction and behavior. 2 Corinthians 4:13, but having the same spirit of faith, according to what is written, I believed, therefore I spoke. We also believe, therefore we also speak. That's conviction. I firmly believe something, therefore I act in accordance with that belief. Another one, 2 Timothy 1:12. Paul says, for this reason I also suffer these things, but I am not ashamed, for I know whom I have believed, and I'm convinced. Conviction. I am convinced that he's able to guard what I have entrusted to him until that day. So I live and behave this way because I'm convinced of the truth. If your peers have no conviction, they're going to be tossed to and fro by the ideologies of the culture, their emotions, their circumstances, whatever it may be, because they're not governed by the truth. They're not anchored in the truth of God's word. They're governed by external factors. So they're unstable. They're unpredictable. You never know what they're going to do or what they're going to say because there's no consistent convictions driving their behavior. Proverbs 14:15. The naive believes everything, but the sensible man considers his steps. The wise man lives by principles and conviction instead of by being naive, which is, I don't have any godly filter through which I process life, and therefore I'm just taken captive by everything. The culture, my emotions, whatever it might be. James 1:5. But if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it'll be given to him. But he must ask in faith without any doubting. That's conviction. For the one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. For that man ought not to expect that he will receive anything from the Lord, being a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. So a man of two souls, literally. In some contexts, maybe when he's around his church friends or at the church, he kind of behaves like a Christian. But in other contexts, he behaves just like an atheist. Why? Because circumstances dictate his behavior, not conviction. You want to know the best friends to have if you're serious about Christ. They are the ones who have such conviction and steadiness that you already know how they're going to respond without even having to ask them or see them in a particular circumstance. You know, if so-and-so is here, there's no way they'd be doing this. If they were here, they'd be saying this right now. If you go and ask them this question, they're going to respond like this. I can already tell you what they're going to say. Those are the friends you want. That's the friend you want to be. Why? Because that demonstrates you have predictability. And if you have predictability, that means you're living life out of conviction. Any peer without that is a danger to you because there's nothing dictating their behavior. They're vulnerable to any way of thinking, any way of behaving, as long as circumstances are conducive to it. Number 10, here's a big one. Worldliness. Worldliness. A dangerous exposure to and indulgence in the things of the world. Why is that a person to stay away from? Well, for this one, I will have you leave Proverbs and go to John 15. Gospel of John, chapter 15, verse 18. Jesus says some very interesting things here about your relationship with the world. And we're going to define what we mean by the world and worldliness and all those things, but let's start with John 15, 18. If the world hates you, you know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love its own. But because you're not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, because of this the world hates you. Remember the word I said to you, a slave is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. Interesting connection there. Your relationship with Christ dictates your relationship with the world and vice versa. Friendship with the world means you hate Christ. Friendship with Christ means you hate the world. That's why we said earlier last week that your peers are a reflection of your heart and a revealing of your position before God. Right here. Why do we say that? Look at what Jesus says. If you were of the world would love its own. But because you're not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, because of this, the world hates you. Your peers, if they're worldly, if they're of the world and they love you, you're of the world. If people in the world, worldly peers, have opposition to you, then you're friends with Christ. Why is a worldly person a person to stay away from? Because they don't know Christ. They're an unbeliever. A person who loves the world can't know Christ. Now, let's clarify a few things on what we mean when we say loving the world. Worldliness is not watching R-rated movies, or listening to secular music, or reading secular literature, smoking, cussing, having a lot of money or possessions. or knowing a lot of information about what's happening in the world. That's not worldliness. There may be worldly aspects to some of those things, worldly temptations in the midst of those things, but those are not the essence of worldliness. Look at 1 John 2. This is probably the clearest divine commentary we have on what it means to not love the world or be of the world. 1 John 2:15. Do not love the world, nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. That's why we say, if you love the world, you can't know Christ. Right there. Verse 16. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life is not from the Father, but is from the world. The world is passing away, and also its lusts. But the one who does the will of God lives forever. First, the world in this verse that we are not to love is the organized system of human civilization that is actively hostile to God and alienated from God. And John specifies what he means. What's so wicked about it? The world's characterized by the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes. Now, the first two refer to desires for what we don't have. We're just constantly lusting or desiring for what we don't have. The never-ending, never-satisfied lust for more, for better, for a change in circumstances. Could be sinful desires, or it could be normal desires that we're desiring to such a degree that they become idols. That third phrase, the pride of life, refers to the pride in what we do have, boasting what we have or who we are, what we've accomplished. So you can see worldliness is either an anti-God response to what I already have, an ungodly response to what I already have, and an ungodly desire for more of what I actually don't have. That's worldliness. Passion for pleasure, pride in possessions. It's where self is God. I do what I want, my lust, my desire. I do what I want, when I want, how I want, because worldliness basically means I'm on the throne and no one can tell me what to do. It's also the growing affections and preoccupation with things that have ultimately no future and no value. Verse 17, the world's passing away and also its lust. So if our affections and our loves are for things that are merely temporary, that's worldliness. It's to gratify and exalt oneself to the exclusion of God. One author says it this way. I found this helpful. Worldliness is to move forward rather than upward. To live horizontally rather than vertically. To seek outward prosperity rather than holiness. To burst with selfish desires rather than heartfelt supplications. If not to deny God, it's to ignore Him and forget Him. Or else only use Him to get our own selfish desires. Worldliness is human nature without God. So, it's idolatry in a heart that is comfortable either in abandoning God or just ignoring God. It's when a legitimate desire becomes a silent demand, when a normal interest becomes a preoccupation, when a like or a preference morphs into an obsession. So you can see worldliness is much broader than how we typically think about it. What might be some practical evidences of worldliness for young people? Now, this is typically where we jump first without understanding what worldliness is, but there are some practical manifestations in how it might show up. Here's one. Dressing in such a way as to draw attention to or promote my body or certain features on my body. Why is that worldliness? That's pride in possessions. 1 John 2. You're trying to draw attention to what you have. You're trying to boast in what you have. You're trying to draw attention to yourself and not God. That's why that's worldliness. Misplaced affections. If you're more excited about just anything on the earth, a new game, a new movie coming out, or more excited about something than you are about Christ, than you are about serving Christ or what you're learning in His Word, that's worldliness. If you're drawn to people and respect people more for their physical attractiveness than for their character. If your heroes and the people you most want to be like are Hollywood stars, professional athletes, irrespective of their character or morality, you've been seduced by worldliness. Any secular opinions and viewpoints are evidences of worldliness. How do these show up today? redefinition of marriage, the equating of men and women's roles in marriage and family and church life. This is worldliness. Why? It's human nature attempting to live and exist without God. Humans define the standard and not God. Self-admiration, that's worldliness. A preoccupation with my body, my looks, my accomplishments, taking pride in, finding significance in a title, a status, an accomplishment, that's worldliness. Jealousy in friendships is an evidence of worldliness because you are trying to maintain friendships to the exclusion of God. It's friendships where I'm God, therefore I have to jealously grab your affection and grab your friendship. That's worldliness. For jealousy to exist, you have to believe that other people belong to me, and the purpose of this friendship is ultimately me, my pleasure, my satisfaction. How can you know if a friendship is threatening to take God's place in your heart? How do you know if you have a worldly friendship, thinking about it from the perspective of jealousy? Well, here are a few indicators. Indicators of jealousy or worldliness in your relationship. Do you feel a sense of possessiveness toward your friend, and you experience jealousy when your friend spends time with others? Do you prefer to spend time alone with your friend, and are you easily frustrated when others join in? You know, you thought it was just going to be the two of you going to hang out, but then somebody else got invited and you're angered by that. Are you hesitant or even unwilling to make plans, short or long term, that don't include your friend? Do you avoid conflict with your friend for fear of losing the relationship? Are flattering words or praise common in your friendships? For example, you're the only one who understands me. I don't know what I'd do without you. Do you operate like a couple? Do others see you as inseparable? Do you frequently ask permission from a friend to do certain things? Are you more physically affectionate toward this friend than other friends? Are you so physically affectionate that in a way that makes others uncomfortable and makes them question the nature of the relationship? That's a sign of a worldly relationship. Do you feel like you couldn't live without this friend? Well, a friend like that can't be a biblical friend because they are set on consuming you, not serving you. You exist for their own selfish ends if there's jealousy in that friendship. And that's a sign of worldliness because it is attempting to exist apart from God and define that friendship apart from God. Here's another way that worldliness shows up in young people today, especially in our culture. And it's what we could call individual expressionism or self-expression. That's another sign of worldliness where you conform to the modern age and think the culture can determine your identity and significance. Here's how I'm defining that. Self-expression or self-expressionism, it's a movement in our culture which says that we are people who are free to say and do whatever we want and be whoever we want and express ourselves however we want, whenever we want. So you buy into the lie that to be in conformity with others, all conformity is evil. And the way that they've always been done, that's just not right. I don't need to look like other men or other women. That's a restriction. And I have the right to express myself any way I feel like, because this is how I feel. And I'd be a hypocrite. I'd be restricting my true self if I didn't do this. So to conform to the cultural and historical standards in society is almost viewed as restrictive at best and evil at worst. That's self-expressionism. It's all over our culture today. I am who I am. This is how God made me. I can be whoever I want to be. I can portray myself in any way I want. That's worldliness. It's finding significance apart from God. It's drawing attention to myself rather than God. It's the lust of the flesh. Now, it's funny because this one will be challenged in the church by young people. They're going to challenge us, and it's going to say, the sanctified challenge will sound like this. Am I not free in Christ to dress or look drastically different from other people as long as I'm not sinning in any way? Am I not free to express my opinions passionately about self-expression on social media and other venues as long as I'm not sinning? Isn't it okay to do that? Well, on the one hand, I'd say yes. On the one hand, just because you choose to be different and express yourself in a way that stands out doesn't mean you're sinning. Just that. But hopefully you evaluate yourself with a little more scrutiny. than just that one question. The question you've got to get around to is, what's driving my desire to be so self-expressive and different than the norm? What's driving that? What godly principles am I employing in my lust for self-expression? So not only what's wrong with it, we should never stop at that question, it's what's godly about it? What's godly about it? What's Christ-like about it? I don't know if you've noticed this, but the last thing we need more of in our culture are people who take pride in who they are and have no intention of changing. That's the last thing we need. Humility should cause us to ask this question. Does the world really need more of me? Is that the problem in the world today? A lack of my self-expression, really? Now, granted, there is a certain sense in which true friends around them, we should be free around in that sense, right? We can be ourselves. This principle is not denying that. What I'm saying here is that the relationships you need are not the ones that promote you being yourself just the way you are, but rather the ones that encourage you to become a more sanctified version of yourself. That's your greatest need. The best friendships are those who have a mutual mindset of myself needs to change and grow a little bit each day. I don't want to be the myself I was yesterday. I want to be the myself that Christ has called me to be and that you're going to help me be. So if you have a peer that's all about self-expression, I can be who I am, how I want, when I want, that's dangerous. That's a worldly influence. Number 11, shallowness. Shallowness. Often a curse in younger peer groups. I've even heard young people in our church say that. You know, it's hard to develop Christ-like friendships because it's so trivial and shallow. You guys have said that about yourselves long before this series. One of the more memorable ways I've heard it put is this. A shallow person is simply alive because air is free. That's a shallow person. People who just really have no purpose for existence or talking about anything, but they're just there to kind of fill up space. Talking about trivialities like the weather or food or their favorite video game or TV series and never able to take discussions and relationships past that level. It's not that those things are wrong, they just don't ever go past it. And that's a level that's comfortable and easy for the flesh. Proverbs 1:22. Let's look at this one. Proverbs 1:22. Proverbs 1:22. How long, O naive ones, will you love being simple-minded? And scoffers delight themselves in scoffing, and fools hate knowledge. That's the problem. Our flesh loves to be shallow, to be simple-minded, to not have to think critically and deeply about the truth. You know, if we only hang out with superficial people, we are going to be superficial people. Hebrews 10:24, let us consider, let us think about, ponder how to stir up one another to love. That's a good friend. He's constantly considering how to stir you up to love and affection for Christ. Shallow relationships can't fulfill what friendship is designed for. And ironically, it is those who are entering into relationships with that shallow mindset that have trouble actually developing friendships. C.S. Lewis said this. And remember, he said it, I didn't. This is why those pathetic people who simply want friends can never make any. The very condition of having friends is that we should want something else besides friends. Friendship must be about something. Those who have nothing, those who are shallow, can share nothing. Those who are going nowhere can have no fellow travelers. He's right. Ultimately, prolonged shallowness in relationships is unbelief and disobedience. Why do I say that? Unbelief in the reason, the design God has put people in your life, and disobedience to what God has called you to in your relationships with them. He's called you to stir them up, to challenge them, to edify them. And you say, well, what are some practical ways I can work on not being shallow? Well, now we're asking the right question. to take my relationship past the level of superficiality so I can get past talking about my favorite game or the weather or food or whatever it might be? How do I get to the point where I can start to have some substance? Here are a few conversation starters. How can I pray for you? What are you struggling to believe or live right now? Where have you experienced God's grace in your struggle? Where has God been good to you recently? What is currently bringing joy to your heart? Where do you see me growing spiritually? How can I be a better biblical friend to you? See, do you know how your friends are doing? How their hearts are? The spiritual condition of their soul? If we only have shallow relationships, we're not going to have any idea about the spiritual status of our friends. We're going to have a superficial acquaintance, not a friendship. So, those are some red flags that you're looking for. There would certainly be more if we wanted to spend time, but I tried to narrow it down on what might be the most prevalent in young people. Those are some of the red flags you're looking for, and again, it's not that you're abandoning people if you see these red flags, but you're certainly beginning to put pressure on them and challenge them and see if they respond. And if you see a willing and humble response, a battle with those things, then I think you can come alongside that person and link arms, and that can be a friendship. It's when you see the stubborn, the unwillingness, the unwillingness to acknowledge it as a weakness or sin, that's when you want to start to drift. So let's take some characteristics or evidences that you should be looking for. So now let's look at some green flags. Who are the people I should drift toward? We just looked at drifting away. Let's drift toward some. This will go quicker because it's really just the opposite of everything we just said. You're just looking at the godly counterpart. So instead of ungodly viewpoints and speculations, you're looking for those who conform their views and opinions to the scriptures. They're backing up everything they're saying with a principle or a text. Here's why I think the way I do. It's because of this principle or this passage. Instead of anti-authority, you're looking for those who humbly embrace and submit to all the God-ordained authority structures in their lives. It might be employers, teachers, parents, pastors, government officials, whatever it might be. Humble submission. Humbly interacting with those in authority in their lives. That's a green flag. Instead of gross hypocrisy, there's genuine character. They are relatively the same people at church and in your peer group when parents are not around, when pastors are not around. There's continuity between them in all contexts. So genuine character. Instead of deceitful or hurtful speech, they speak gracious words motivated to build up others. They protect the reputation of others. They even speak up for them when they're slandered. They ask questions like, how can I help you protect that person who's not here to defend himself? Instead of an inability to control sinful emotions, they have self-control and restraint, and they're not given over easily to fits of emotion. Instead of loving and promoting sin, they love holiness, and they promote it in their lives and yours. Instead of a lack of teachability, they welcome instruction. They avail themselves of all the various forms of being equipped, and they seek out not only strong peers, but also older, more mature Christians to grow and learn from. Instead of a lack of conviction, they have firmly held beliefs, and they will not budge. They're predictable in their speech and actions. Instead of worldliness, their affections are placed in Christ and His people. Instead of shallowness, their substance, they raise the relationship from the trivial to the noble and worthy things. So those are all the opposites of what we considered for the red flags. Let's add a few more now, a few more things that you're looking for. Conversion. Someone who has a credible Christian testimony. Don't assume that just because your peers are in the church and consistently serve at church, consistently read their Bibles or know their Bibles, that they're necessarily Christian. Don't assume that. Get to know them. If they're professing Christ, ask them how they came to Christ. Ask them how their relationship with God changed once they came to Christ. How their relationship with sin changed once they were converted. Listen to them talk and see if they even understand the gospel, which they profess to believe. What do I need to know to be saved? Ask them that question. See if they can answer it. Remember, someone who's not a Christian, they're incapable of having a biblical friendship. Why? They can't have a worthy motive for friendship. They're incapable of desiring the friends they should desire. They're not going to have a biblical value system to evaluate things. And they're going to be incapable of treating you despite your performance. They're going to be incapable of treating you with the love and edification and forgiveness that friendship is really about. So first and foremost, you're really looking for conversion. And just to review for all of us, a Christian is someone who has been justified by faith in the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, and someone who is being sanctified, becoming more godly. That's a Christian. Another one here. So conversion. Now let's look at another one. Sacrificial service. You're looking for someone who sacrificially serves. John 15:13. Greater love has no one than this, that one lay down his life for his friends. So you're looking for a servant of others. Now we're going to narrow in on two areas here that this is primarily going to show up. First, look at how they use their gifts in the church. Look at how they serve the church. Are they grumbling when they serve? Are they absent in service? Or are they joyful and energetic in their service? Secondly, and this will be a fun one, look at how they relate to their siblings, their home life. Do they treat their home life, their family, like a bed and breakfast? It's just somewhere I stay. I get showers, meals, free entertainment, and endless relaxation. I don't have any obligation to my siblings. They're just there. I acknowledge they're alive. They take up space. They breathe in some of my air. I love them because it's natural for me to love them, but I don't serve them. I'm certainly not obligated to die to myself to serve them. That's typically how we view siblings. Well, if your friends don't serve people they are closest to, they don't understand sacrificial love. Anybody can serve people they only see for a couple hours a week. It takes the Spirit of God to die to yourself for people who annoy you and who you see sin and you sin against and they sin against you. That's where you want to measure it. So look at those closest to them and see how they relate. Do they have a servant's mindset? Three if we're beginning after we left the red flags, but the third one of the new principles, transparency. Transparency. Proverbs 18:1. Whoever isolates himself seeks his own desire. He breaks out against all sound judgment. And that isolation can come in the form of not developing close relationships. A relational or emotional isolation from others because they don't want to let people into their life. They don't want to be hurt. It's self-preservation. That's not a good ingredient for biblical friendship. Listen to what Jesus says in John 15:15. No longer do I call you slaves, for the slave does not know what his master is doing. But I've called you friends, for all things that I have heard from my Father, I've made known to you. Transparency. These words remind us that sharing ourselves, transparency is at the heart of friendship. Number four, faithfulness. We could call this one constantly or consistently committed over time. Take a look at a few of these proverbs. Proverbs 17:17. We're going to see this idea of faithfulness here in true friendship. Proverbs 17:17. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. 18:24. A man of too many friends comes to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. And now 20:6. Many a man proclaims his own loyalty, but who can find a trustworthy man? Why do so many friendships end when sin or conflict or tragedy enters that relationship? Because one or both friends were not faithfully committed to each other. Their friendship was easily disposable. Think about friendships of young people, which is typical today. They treat friendships like this. One day you're in, the next day you're out. I found out you slandered me in my peer group. All right, we're done. We went from best friends, inseparable, to I'm not talking to you the rest of my life. Because of one instance of slander or some perceived hurt. Well, we see in those Proverbs that biblical friendship perseveres through good and bad times. That's how you can spot a good friend. Will they come around? Will they draw nearer to you through adversity and not distance themselves in adversity, even if they're the ones who caused it? Number five, very similar to the last one, but really narrowing in on that. You're looking for someone who's willing to wound and be wounded. Proverbs 27:6. 27:6, faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. Your flatterers in your life are not friends. They're enemies because they build you up with insincere words and don't love you enough to speak into your life at a challenging level. A biblical friend is willing to wound and be wounded. The silence in the face of a friend's sin is no act of love, but the wounds of correction are, however uncomfortable it may be to inflict them. So a friend is someone who's going to be willing to be uncomfortable for your sake. You want a friend who has the humility to receive rebuke and the conviction and courage to give it. That's who you're looking for. Proverbs 28:23, whoever rebukes a man will afterward find more favor than he who flatters with his tongue. That's it. Uncomfortable honesty wins out over the path of least resistance. Uncomfortably honest, that's what you want. Now, you're not looking to be, nor are you looking for a nagger, a micromanager in your life who doesn't trust the Spirit of God to work. Someone who every time they see you, there they are just slapping you in the face with some Bible verse and telling you how sinful you are. That's not what I'm talking about. However, I'll take that person over the person who doesn't care about anything, who never speaks up. I'll take the person who needs a little help in being patient and wise and discerning when they speak, instead of the person who it's not even on their radar to speak, nor would they have anything profitable to say if they did. So those are some things to be looking for when evaluating your friendships. We looked at some red flags, we looked at some green flags, certainly not a comprehensive list, but enough to have the proper categories in place to pursue these relationships at this point. Now, I want to transition to our next truth now. We just looked at biblical friendships require biblical evaluation. And now the next one. Biblical friendship has biblical expectations. Biblical expectations. Biblical friendship should not be expected to fulfill or satisfy your longings. On the contrary, biblical friendship should expect to be sinned against, to be offended, to not live up to the expectations of your fallen flesh. If you've ever wondered why friendship or any other relationship is difficult, the general answer is very easy. Sin. Idolatry in the relationship. Think about it. Think about from Adam and Eve. Turn to Genesis 3. Genesis 3:6. We're going to see what happened to them when sin entered the relationship. They enjoyed a perfect friendship for a period of time in a sinless existence. But as soon as they fell into sin, their perfect communion with one another was shattered. Genesis 3:6, when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and that the tree was desirable to make one wise, she took from its fruit and ate, and she gave also to her husband with her, and he ate. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and now notice where the focus of the relationship goes. They knew that they were naked. Self-focus. Sin makes you turn inward. And now self-preservation. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loin coverings. I have to protect myself from you. You're now a threat to me. That's what sin does in relationships. So self-centeredness with one another. What happens when sin enters friendships? We quickly becomes I. I'm no longer concerned about the other person. Now I'm concerned with myself. So we view ourselves as the most important person in the relationship, and we preserve ourselves and expose others. That's exactly what happened with Adam and Eve. You remember as the story goes on, they start blaming everyone but themselves for what happened. We turns to I. That is why I, myself, become the subject of all the questions I ask to evaluate a friendship. Do they like me? What do they think of me? Why they do that to me? Will they hurt me again? Will they always feel this way about me? Will they ever turn their back on me? What are they saying to others about me? They make me feel great about myself. I can be myself around them. I don't feel vulnerable. Me, 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 I. That's idolatry in relationships. And when we engage in relationships without recognizing that is in all of our hearts, we're going to be let down. We're entering in with unbiblical expectations. So this means we should not be seeking perfect relational satisfaction in imperfect people. The irony is that when we reverse the order and we elevate people above God, we end up ruining the earthly relationships that we're longing to be perfect for. That doesn't mean that we ignore sin, that we condone sin, but it does mean that we accept the fact that our friendships are going to be far from perfect. And we accept the fact that no friend will ever be sinless. You have never had, nor have you ever been, a perfect friend. There's only one friend who is perfect, who will never abandon you or let you down in any way. That's Christ himself. Everyone else will offend you. Everyone else will sin against you. I like to think about it this way. If it happened to Christ, who is sinless, I shouldn't be surprised if it happens to me, who is sinful. What happened to Christ in his friendships? He was betrayed by a friend. Yeah. You're no better than Christ, and one of Christ's friends betrayed him. David said it first in Psalm 41:9. Then Jesus quotes it to speak of what Judas is doing in that relationship. John 13:18. Even my close friend in whom I trusted, who ate my bread, has lifted up his heel against me. He's turned against me. Notice that language. Close friend, trusted, ate bread together. We had intimate communion and fellowship with one another, companionship, and he turned against me. Turned against me. Psalm 55:12. For it's not an enemy who reproaches me, then I could bear it. Nor is it one who hates me, who's exalted himself against me, then I could hide myself from him. But it's you, a man, my equal, my companion, my familiar friend, who we had sweet fellowship together. There's betrayal. The Bible has a category for it. Your friends may betray you. Have that expectation. Be prepared for it. Don't be skeptical of them, but enter in with biblical expectations. Biblical expectations. We relate to one another, not as righteous saints, but as unrighteous sinners. You're a sinner, I'm a sinner, that's our friendship. We recognize we're not satisfied with where we're at. We're helping each other to grow out from those things. But let's not forget that we're both sinners. And while we're dealing with unbiblical expectations, we have to recognize you can't expect to have a substantial number of close biblical friendships. All relationships will be different. Some people in your life you can categorize as strangers. You're still called to love them as you love yourself, but you have no knowledge of them. They're not part of your life in any way. Then you have people who are your acquaintances, right? You know them, but you share little with them and they with you. They're really your neighbors. There's an awareness of them, a superficial knowledge of them. Again, you serve and love them as you have opportunity, but you really only know them through other people or unexpected circumstances. The next level of relationships in your life, companions. You have some regular interaction with them, maybe not a lot of one-on-one. You certainly know them through other people and in group settings, maybe even share some similar hobbies. You might share some personal things with them, but not at the intimate, deepest level. And then I would say your next level would be your close biblical friendships. Very close friends who are as one soul with you, with whom you share your deepest hopes and fears, where you're involved in each other's lives to such a degree there's mutual edification, promoting godliness, and protecting from sin. All that to say, I give you those categories not because you can automatically just fit every person in one of them, but it helps us to see that it's not wrong to relate to people in different ways in those different categories. Jesus, for instance, related to the crowds, the larger group of disciples, the inner group, the 12 disciples, and Peter, James, and John, all in different ways. The crowds were strangers and neighbors. The larger disciple group were his companions. The 12 disciples who became apostles were his friends. And Peter, James, and John, those were his friends at the most intimate level. He was clearly had a closer and more intimate relationship with them than anyone else. That shows us that even the sinless Son of God wasn't close, intimate friends with everyone. He maintained a limited number of what we're calling biblical friendships. So, biblical friendships don't really emerge from striving or grasping for them, always trying to manufacture them. Rather, they emerge from a gospel-motivated willingness to serve and love others, and a trust that God will gradually guide us into the friendships that are good for us. If we remember that everyone has a limited capacity for friendships, and no one's better than Christ, and everyone's a sinner prone to offend me in some way, we can avoid being taken captive by false expectations. So these are some biblical expectations that we should have when we think about friendships. Don't expect friends to be perfect, to be flawless, to be righteous saints, and don't expect friends to satisfy your desire for fulfillment and happiness. That's not what friendship is about. And don't expect to be close, intimate friends with every person. That's not how it works. You just can't snap your fingers and decide who you're going to be close with. Friendship takes at least two people. So those are a few expectations to think about. Now I'm just going to give you very briefly a few concluding practical considerations. And these I'm going to pose in the form of questions. So questions that may be on your mind. I think there's three of them. Here's the first one. What if I find myself in a season where friends are hard to come by? What if I look around and I see peers developing these friendships, but I always seem to be on the outside, and I've done everything I can and I just can't figure it out? What's wrong with me? All right. First thing I would say, you've got to recognize that friendship is not about what we need as much as it is about who we need to be. Okay, similar to when you're ready for marriage. It's not about finding Mr. or Mrs. Right. It's about becoming Mr. or Mrs. Right. That's where your focus needs to be. So take this season to do some personal examination. Am I doing everything I'm called to do to cultivate godly friendship? Or am I waiting to be served before I'll extend myself? Do I have a warm and friendly demeanor about me that welcomes people instead of a harsh, proud, or antisocial personality? If I don't like talking, if I make other people feel awkward when I'm around them, or maybe I talk too much, I probably shouldn't question why I don't have the closer friendships that I'm desiring. Am I paralyzed by the fear of man and rejection? Is that why I don't have friendship? Am I consumed with the wrong questions? Like, what's wrong with other people? Why don't they reach out to me? And instead, start asking good questions. What's wrong about my perspective? What's wrong with me? Have I reached out to them? Am I self-focused? Has my phone become my best friend so that when I'm around my peers, I distance myself from them emotionally and relationally, and I sit there and play on my phone while others are right in front of me, actively engaged in discussion? Well, of course. Of course you're not going to have deep friendships if your best friend is your phone. That's not only a sign of selfishness, that's a lack of consideration for others. It's also a sign that maybe you prefer the more comfortable electronic relationships than real relationships. Because technology, what does it do? It allows us to keep people at safe distances and it's friendship on our terms. I can go on Facebook and I can get just enough of you. But just as much as I want, and I can offer just as much of myself and not more, and no one's going to say anything about it. So technology allows us to have not too close, not too far, just right, superficial relationships that our flesh loves. Is that why I don't have friendships? Because in person, I actually have to die to myself. I have to be uncomfortable in order to develop relationships. So I just go for the electronic version. So take this season and ask yourself the hard questions. Do I take the initiative in my friendships? Do I sacrifice in my friendships? Do I appreciate my friends for who they are or merely what they can give me? Do I really want close friends? Am I honestly committed to the type of sacrifice and energy and effort required for biblical friendships? And do I turn to God for friendship? Is Christ first and foremost my friend before I ever think about extending myself to others? So, first of all, if I want friends but I'm having trouble making any, use this as a season of personal examination. Secondly, use this providential test in your life to cultivate contentment and trust in the Lord. Use this season, I'm going to make up a word, of friendshiplessness, there it is, as a means by which to grow your faith and dependence on Him. Trust God's character and sovereignty to such a degree that you can say with the psalmist in Psalm 84:11, no good thing does He withhold from those who walk uprightly. If you're striving to be godly, you have everything you need in this season of life. So, don't waste your friendshiplessness if you're in that category. Second question, what do I do when I recognize I need a major overhaul in my peer group? What steps do I take now that I recognize I have some ungodly or maybe just unhealthy, unprofitable relationships in my life? What do I do now? Well, remember, we mentioned last time, don't use this as a grenade, launch it into your peer group and blow it up with one speech or one act. That's foolish. Relationship to relationship, conversation to conversation. Rise above the shallow and superficiality tone in that relationship and start to ask the deeper questions, the more substantive questions. And as you start to become the type of person that's concerned with these things, you'll realize, I don't have to make some dramatic break, because those who are serious about Christ, they're going to drift toward me, and those who aren't serious about Christ, they're going to naturally drift away, because my godly living is going to shed light on their defective love of Christ. You won't have to make some dramatic break. Third question, and we'll end with this. How can my peers be biblical friends, leading me to greater Christ-likeness, promoting godliness, protecting me from sin, when they're just like me? They're immature. They're lacking assurance. They're lacking wisdom. They're lacking knowledge. How can my peers do that when I don't think they're really serious about Christ? Well, first, that's the reason you're developing relationships with people who are older than you. Find someone, no matter what age they are, to start pouring into your life. Secondly, remember, friendship is a gift. It's a privilege. It's not guaranteed. And for seasons, you may not have godly friends because no one you know in your age group, maybe they're not concerned about those things. Maybe you're going to be the only one. Is that sufficient motivation for you? Thirdly, become the type of person a biblical friend needs to be. If no one else is concerned about these things, you be the lone person committed to them. You be the person that people are going to want to come to. You become the strong link in your peer group. Fourthly, don't settle. Do not compromise. Friendships are not a need in your life. If there are no godly people in your peer group to be friends with, then God has called you to a friendless season. That's it. You can have companions, friends, you can hang out, do all that stuff, but you can't have biblical friendships if no one's serious about Christ. Cultivate your relationship with Christ and with older people until you start to see the Lord working in the lives of your peers. So we're out of time. Let me pray for us.